Thanks first to Rabbi Julius Berman for being so kind to arrange for us to have Rabbi Lichtenstein here tonight. Rabbi Lichtenstein does not need any great introduction because he's well known throughout the whole world, actually, not only in Israel and the United States. His influence on Jewish students Thanks first to Rabbi Julius Berman for being so kind to arrange for us to have Rabbi Lichtenstein here tonight. Rabbi Lichtenstein does not need any great introduction because he's well known throughout the whole world, actually, not only in Israel and the United States. His influence on Jewish students and religious life in Israel is well known, as well as the students that go through a program in Israel, then come to the United States and are imbued with Torah and knowledge and intellectual curiosity and continue this in their daily life. It's really a great pleasure for me tonight to call upon Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein to deliver our lecture.
Wagner, the chairman, ladies and gentlemen. Gemara Kedushin quotes a braise, Tanya, Rebbe Omer, Golu v'yodua lefne mishom avoha yaholo, shebein mechabed es imo yosu me'ovi, v'pnei shemeshadal to be'idvori, v'fichoch, hikti ma'kodesh boruch u'kibudav le'kibudei. Golu v'yodua lefne mishom avoha yaholo, shebein misyore me'ovi yosu me'imo, v'pnei shemelamdo Torah. לפיכך, היקטים הקדש ברוך הוא מורה אוף למורה אי. Abbas says that Ben Shalem knows full well that his son is inclined to honor, to cherish his mother more than his father, because she fondles him, she spoils him. Therefore, the pasuk which speaks in the mitzvah of kibud, kabe desavicha v'simecha, the father is mentioned before the mother. Likewise, it is well known to the Ben Shleilo that a child fears a father more than the mother, as the father disciplines him in the process of teaching him Torah. Therefore, the pasuk which speaks in the mitzvah of mora, fear of a parent, ish aviv imo, imav aviv tiro, there the pasuk in reverse has father mentioned after the mother. Just this maimel, cited in summary by Rashi in Parshas Kedoshim, is similar to most of them. Addressing himself in disparate sequences of the psukim, dealing with the fear and honor of parents respectively, the mother receiving priority in the former, while the father is cited first in the latter. Rabbi suggests that the Torah has made allowances for natural tendencies, and has sought to compensate for them. In each case, emphasizing precisely that which runs counter to ordinary inclination. This technique of counterbalancing proclivity has numerous halachic applications. It is, of course, equally valid with respect to the world of thought in general. Thus, speaking of human self-esteem, Pascal writes, "If he shall pride himself, I shall abase him. If he shall abase himself, I shall uplift him, until he understands qu'il est monstre incompréhensible." that he's an incomprehensible monster. I may interject a personal note. I often find that my position, professional as well as ideological, leads, nay, at times perhaps necessitates me to present seemingly contradictory and yet ultimately complementary views to different audiences. Inclined to maintain and expound perspectives which are multifaceted, and inasmuch as my purpose is not only exposition but exhortation, I frequently find myself espousing different sides of the same issue, emphasizing, for instance, to those who denigrate the mandate implicit in the pasuk in Bereishis, Yikach Hashem Elokim es Adam v'yinicheu v'gan Eden l'avdo l'shamra, the Ben Shlolem took man and placed him in the Garden of Eden to till it and to preserve it, emphasizing, that is, to those who denigrate man's duty to God to develop the world, that he main kemach ein Torah, there's no material base, there can be no spiritual existence either. While stressing to those who minimize the centrality of spiritual attainment, that the main Torah ein kemach, as the Gemara Shabbos explains, the very existence of the world is teleologically, in order that Torah exists and be studied, the light of the Pasuk in Yom, were it not for my covenant day and night, I would not have established the laws of heaven and earth. Or again, confronted by students present with perspective who are excessively gung-ho on military service, I often seek to dampen their fervor, underscoring the spiritual character of our tradition, downgrading the importance of army duty, which is after all only the fortunate necessary means to an end, and stressing that end is Torah, and more Torah. On the other hand, addressing others to whom the latter message has been incessantly and almost exclusively drilled, I take the reverse tack. I would remind them, don't you recall the Gemara in Yevamos, that kol ha'omer ein lo elo Torah afilo Torah ein lo, the person who thinks that he has and there is nothing but Torah doesn't even possess Torah itself. And don't you realize that ideally Torah must be Torah's chesed? And thus, preaching piety to intellectualists and intellectuality to the pietists, we strive to attain the complex balance which I regard as the essence of a comprehensive and healthy hashkofa. I preface my remarks with this brief introduction because compensatory balance is the essence of this evening's message. It is my contention that with respect to such central issues, as orientation to past, present, and future respectively, or the prevalent conception of that future, very different emphases exist within different segments of the Jewish and Torah community. And that we would be well advised to press upon each the significance of that which he is inclined to minimize or disregard. Lefikach hikti makos. Not knowing, however, although I can perhaps hazard an intelligent guess, the composition of this audience, I shall perforce attempt to present the total picture. But let me specify. I don't know how many of you vividly recall the passage near the end of Macbeth, from which, perhaps pretentiously and presumptuously, I've drawn the title for this lecture. Those who do recall will note that informed that his wife, the queen, had died, and Macbeth responds, she should have died hereafter. It would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, creeps in this petty pace from day to day, the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays are lighted fools, the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candles. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. There's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Depending on your critical point of view, Shakespeare generally is regarded as representative of his age, as the timeless bard of the human spirit, or as bestriding like a colossus the transition from pre-17th century medieval and Renaissance culture to the modern order. As regards this passionate outburst in particular, of course, inasmuch as he is a dramatist, it is not necessarily to be regarded as Shakespeare's final, definitive word with respect to the human condition, nor, since ein adam nitfas al tzaro, a person cannot hold fully accountable that which he says in a moment of crisis, of pain, even if that should indeed interest us, should it necessarily be regarded as Macbeth's final word. But the outburst per se, taken in itself, is decidedly unmodern in tone and substance. The lumping together of all our yesterdays in a chain of tomorrows is nothing more than the venue of meaningless sound and fury. All this on the road to dusty death expresses a pessimism and a nihilism which is alien to what, broadly speaking, one abhors such generalizations in this context are unavoidable, but generally speaking may be described as the modern spirit. The modern world is by and large optimistic. From a religious point of view, perhaps superficially so, and yet, subjectively speaking, optimistic. Spurred on by dazzling scientific and technological advances, it has, far more than its predecessors, a sense of being able to cope and ultimately master, of the capacity, as Whitehead and science of the modern world noted, to understand the world, and inasmuch as the prime precursor of modernity, Francis Bacon noted, knowledge is power, of being able gradually to extend control over it. It has to a great extent Faustian appetites while yet entertaining the hope that it can avoid the Faustian denouement. Perhaps few share the unbridled hopefulness of Shelley's father-in-law, William Godwin, that in due time, death itself shall be overcome and man attain immortality. But the spirit of hope, at the popular level, even more than at the philosophic, is fairly prevalent. Even nihilism often has a different quality in this context. Much of secular nihilism is a very different order from the pre-modern variety. Terminal personal life, that's the ball game from a nihilist secular perspective, is regarded not in terms analogous to the Avel Avolim, Hakol Havel, of the early Pakim Kelts, as indeed signifying nothing, but rather is a morally significant process of self-assertion. Thus, the bravado of Bertrand Russell on the one hand, and the genuine bravery of Albert Camus on the other. So that, from this point of view, is Pascal himself, of course, deeply religious, but in many respects regarded as an antecedent of contemporary existentialism. As Pascal stated, even as the universe crushes man, he triumphs over it because he, the thinking reed, aux pensant, knows that he's being crushed. To be sure, the zeitgeist of our century, marked by two cataclysmic wars, is quite different from the century of hope, the 19th century Europe dominated by Pax Britannicus, or, to go back one further, that which is the matrix of what Carl Becker in a celebrated book called the heavenly city of the 18th century philosophers. Yet, the gut feeling, and this I say, the lament of Arnold, Eliot, Beckett, and many others, about the diminished spiritual parameters of modern culture notwithstanding, the prevalent feeling, again, especially the popular feeling, is one of expectancy. This sense is directly related, directly bound up, with a relation to different time frames. The modern world is largely present, and even more so, future-oriented. It relates, of course, to the past, and attitudes to the past vary. Voltaire's écraser l'histoire, strike out history, it's all one great mistake, obviously contrasts sharply with the historicist attitudes prevalent since the early 19th century, in which history, of course, is by and large regarded in a much more positive light. And yet, for all their interest in history, Romantics and their successors generally did not see the past as the ultimate ideal or as the arbiter of the present. Not even in Ben Jonson's sense of guides, not commanders. They saw it rather as the matrix out of which, through dimly perceived processes, higher culture had and would continue to evolve. In the so-called Battle of the Books, lampooned in Swift's late 17th century Tale of a Tub, which different books come off the bookcase and begin to fight each other, the moderns rise up against the ancients to proclaim not only their independence, that was audacious enough, but even their prospective superiority. The future, that to which modernity is so much oriented, open, malleable, indeterminate, is full of promise. And it is hence to that that modern man typically looks. Proust, with incessant monomaniac longing to recapture le temps perdu, remembrance of things past, is in this respect very much an aberration. Futurism of one kind or another is far more representative. This quality relates in turn to another characteristic. It is a cliché of cultural history that modern man is more this-worldly, more terrestrially oriented than his predecessors. He attaches more value to the mundane and is far more attuned to regarding it as existential milieu. In Wordsworth's phrase, it's the world within which we find our happiness, or not at all. Hence, he experiences, with respect to the future, both an extension and a constriction of horizons. Macbeth's tomorrow, tomorrow, and tomorrow speaks, of course, of identical units within a sequence. I shall, however, al derech hadrush, take the liberty of speaking of three very different tomorrows. The title of the lecture, I thought too, might be mystifying enough. Most familiar, of course, is the pragmatic model, the time frame contiguous to the present, and evolving more or less continuously from it. Generally, in both popular literary usage, this refers literally to the following day. Now, this is by far the most common meaning to the equivalent term macho in Tanakh, as in the parsha which we read in Purim at the end of Bishalach, Mochor and Ochinitzov al Rosh Agiva, tomorrow I shall stand top of the hill, or as we read on the same day in the Megillah, Nosein Gamochor Ehud Vashem Shushan, let the next day too be given to the Jews of Shushan to clean up their persecutors. At times, however, this contiguous tomorrow may refer to a later date, as in the concluding line of Lycidas, in which Milton speaks of the poet shepherd's dedicated determination to betake himself tomorrow to fresh woods and pastures new. take perhaps a more immediate example, we are within the 30-day period of Kedem HaPesach, during which one engages in Hilchos Pesach. We can remind ourselves of Rashi's comment on the Pasuk in Bo, V'hoyok yisholcha vincha mocha lemo mazos. If your child shall ask you on the morrow, what is this? Rashi explains, yesh mocha shu achsho. There is a tomorrow which is now, meaning it is literally the next day. Yesh mocha, and there is a tomorrow, shulach hazman, which is somewhere in the future. Kegon zeh, such as this instance. Or kegon, with reference to Pasuk in Yeshua, mocha yomru b'neichem livaneinu, livnegod ve'uven. Discussion of the Pasha of Megadu Bnei Ruvain, when they want it implemented in Yeshua. So, other Shvatim said to them, tomorrow your sons will say to our sons. But of course, what was meant was sometime in the future. In both cases, however, regardless of whether it's the Mocho Shalachsho or the Mocho Shalachasma, we are dealing with a future which is related directly, rationally, operationally, pragmatically to the present. And in this respect, this first ordinary machal tomorrow is materially different from a second eschatological tomorrow. The tomorrow, the end of history, or the redemption of history. The future here, conceived not as the practical and, if you will, linear continuation of the present, but rather as its ultimate redemptive fulfillment. Here we deal not so much with a mochar evolving from, emanating from Hayom, as with a Bayom Ahu, another day, that day, contrasted with the Hayom Hasem. A Bayom Ahu, on which Yi Hashem Echot, Shmo Echot, then shall be one, his name will be one, be universally recognized. A Bayom Ahu, which is visionary, messianic, and psychologically, although hopefully not chronologically, remote. This is the machal of Yemos HaMashiach. A machal of days which, however conceived, and of course Rishonim had different views, and Chazal had different views, of how Yemos HaMashiach would relate to the rest of history. But in any event, this is the mocha of a period through and during which history, nature, and man attained the meta-historical redemption, as Mola Horetz Deos Hashem Kamayim Layom Achasi. The world shall be full of the knowledge of the recognition of the Ben Shloilam as the sea and the seabed is covered by water. This then is the second tomorrow. And there is finally the totally ahistorical and atemporal tomorrow. The Mochar evoked by Chazal, Rashi quotes it at the end of Eskana, were addressing themselves to the Pasuk, speaks of mitzvahs pertaining to the present, Hayom La'asosom, to perform them today. Chazal comment, Hayom La'asosom, U'mochar L'kabel Schorot, to do them today, and to receive, to enjoy the rewards tomorrow, subsequently. This tomorrow, that of the world of Umacho Lekabes Schora, relates to the transcendental realm of judgment, to the consequences of judgment, to beatific vision, to tzadikim yoshvim vatroseyem b'rosheyem v'ne'enim ziv ha'shchina. The righteous sit with crowns upon their heads and partake of the glow of the shchina. It is to this world that post-mortem the individual moves vertically, immediately, if you will, as evidenced by the famous description of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's deathbed trepidation in the Gemara in Brachos, explaining why is it he's full of fear and trepidation, explains that even were he being brought before an ordinary ruler, he would be full of tremor, even though he knows that as a mere mortal, whose power is relatively limited, whose stay is ephemeral. But, hey, for sure, Allah is coming with Hamo. ועכשיו שמוליכינו סביף דמלך מלכי הלוחים הקדש ברוך הוא שהוא חי וקיום לעולם ולעול מעולמי שאם כועס עליי כעסו כעס עולם ואם עוסרני איסורו איסור עולם ואם ממיסני מיסוסו מיסס עולם ואין יוכל לפייס בדבורים ולא לשחת בממון ולעול אלא שיש לפני שני דרכים, אחס של גן עדן ואחס של גיהינום, ואין יודע באיזו מוליכים עושים, ולא הפקה. Now that I'm to be hauled off for the Ribbono Shelem, the King of Kings, who is living and existent eternally, if he's angry toward me, his anger is eternal. If he incarcerates me, the incarceration is eternal. If he kills me, death is eternal. And I cannot anyway win him over by words, nor bribe him with money. And moreover, there are two paths front of me, one leading to paradise, the other to hell, and I don't know which path I'm to be led, and I oughtn't to cry. This is the tomorrow of the today of Abirchen's deathbed. It tomorrow, of course, not only the sense that he may be dead within the next 24 hours, but the tomorrow of moving immediately, vertically, as it were, to a different order, to the world of Lekabes Chol. And it is that world of this Macha to which, at least on the Ramban's view, Rambam disagreed, the whole cosmos moves linearly and horizontally on its return to pre-creational vacuity. Su shemayim eneichem l'poskin yishayol v'abitu el oretz mitachas ki shemayim choshanim lochu v'oretz chabeget tivle v'yoshver kmo cheni musum Yishuasi lolon tiyeh v'sitkosi losechos. Lift your eyes heavenward and look at the earth below. For the heavens the smoke will vanish. The earth, as a garment, will wither. Its inhabitants likewise shall die. And my salvation, this of course by contrast, shall endure forever, and my justice shall not disappear. This is the macho of the individual, and the macho of the universe. Three tomorrows then. Tomorrow, which is continuous with the today, if literally Achsho, and if slightly removed. The tomorrow of eschatology, meta-history, of the culmination of human existence, and the tomorrow of the transcendental world of judgment and beatitude. If we ask ourselves, where does the modern world stand with respect to these tomorrows? I believe the general answer can be clearly and briefly stated. It is deeply enmeshed with the first, has little truck with the third, and it attains a particular perception of the second. Given its mundane and temporal bias, its secularity, concerned with cycle of time in the original sense of the term, it is of course very much involved with the present and with the hereafter as an extension of the here and now. Eternity is still part of the picture, and belief in it, surely at the level of articulated dogmatism, widely persists, but often only on the periphery of consciousness. Outright discussion of eternity seems a little uncomfortable, it's a little embarrassing, a little highfalutin. Prevalent attitude is often that which is reflected in the condescending irony in which the former Ben Yeshiva Judah Stanford wrote, and I quote, of mystics with divinity on their lips, dangling eternity on their fingertips. Andrew Marvell, addressing himself to, of all people, his coy mistress, could resonate echoes of impending eternity. At my back I hear time's winged chariot drawing near. Alluding to those lines 3 centuries later in the wasteland, T.S. Eliot could only hear at his back the sound of motor cars. And let us ask ourselves, which modern statesman, soldier, courtier, poet could open the concluding sonnet of a sequence, as did Sir Philip Sidney at the end of Astrophel and Stella, by importuning, leave me a world that reacheth but to dust, and thou my soul aspire to higher things. Grow rich in that which never taketh rust, whatever fades, but fading pleasure brings. As to the second tomorrow, that of meta-history, faith in that of course, persists. It's part of the optimism. It's often very deeply felt. Moreover, it takes two forms. The religious vision of a divine millennium on the one hand, and the secular aspiration for humanistic utopia on the other. Both, however, share a quality which distinguishes them from earlier perceptions. Medieval and Renaissance views of the Last Judgment or its equivalent envisioned it primarily as an epiphanous divine revelation, as God's initiative, clearly disjunct from the continuous historical process. It was something which was almost ex machina, superimposed upon historical reality, but not growing out of it, not evolving, emanating from it. By contrast, the Marxist yearning for a classless society, as well as the longing for one grand divine event to which the whole creation moves, enunciated by Tennyson at the conclusion of In Memoriam, these clearly see the redemption of history as evolving, emanating from within. It's that, that dialectically, as Marx would have it, class struggle leads, and it's to that, towards that, that history moves, in Tennyson's formulation. This is not something which is abruptly set down from above. So we have here different perspectives upon prevalent modern views of varying tomorrows. I, of course, have been invited here not just to discuss modernity per se, but modernity and Judaism, but in Judaism, it's out there. I presume the prevalent assumption was, those who formulated the title for this series, that the two are, in some sense, very much in tandem. Yet, with reference to our particular topic, to some extent, at any rate, surely there is a measure of opposition. Certainly, no committed Jew can accept the largely secular and pragmatic bias of modern culture. Its anthropocentric bent, placing man rather than Ribbono Shel Olam at the center of consciousness and existence. Its relativistic morals, its temporal priorities. No Torah Hashkofe can countenance the extent to which modernity ignores eternity. None can accept the degree of preoccupation with material progress, with social engineering, with economic development, that is so typical of most modern societies. Beyond that, however, beyond this measure of opposition, and it is and should be very, very significant, differences can and do exist within Yahadus with respect to our problem. And I should like to survey these briefly before concluding by returning to my point of departure. As we well know, on many issues, our Orthodox world is divided into two camps. One, variously denominated, is Haredi, right, black, or what have you. The other, loosely described, is modern, centrist, or some equivalent. Dati-Lumi. Many of us don't like this bifurcation. I myself abhor it. But we know that it exists. And we know that the terms formulated this way or that way do, after all, define respective realities. And with an eye to this distinction, if I ask myself, how do these two groups shape up respectively, it is very strong at the extremities of the spectrum. With regard to Ayom La'asosom on the one hand, and Umacho La'kabel Schorom on the other. The one hand, that community has very laudably succeeded, personally and collectively, in focusing upon rigorous halachic observance, upon unswerving faith and dogmatic fidelity. The yeshivas and Talmudei Torah are impressive. The intramural gemilas chasodim enviable. Their concern for dvarim should be kedusha, profound and powerful. On the other hand, their sense of eternity too is relatively strong. Far beyond the modern norm, They entertain a clear sense, both intellectual and existential. Yeshivas and Talmudei Torah are impressive. The intramural gemilas chasodim enviable. Their concern for dvarim should be kedusha, profound and powerful. On the other hand, their sense of eternity, too, is relatively strong. Far beyond the modern norm, they entertain a clear sense, both intellectual and existential, of man's ultimate destiny. To be sure, there is still a far, far cry for Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. I accept, pretty much without qualification, an interesting observation my brother-in-law Rabbi Chaim once made. He observed that while he had davened in the Panovich Yeshiva and Yom Neroim a number of times, he did not get to encounter sense of genuine terror within the Haredi world until the collapse of the bank stocks in 1983. Yet, comparatively speaking, this scamp does strive to realize the admonition of Akavya ben Mahalalel. Heed three things. And you shall be prevented from engaging in sin. Know from whence you came. Whither you are headed. And before whom you are destined to offer judgment and accounting. However, this world is patently weak with respect to the intermediate phases. The machor, which is in between. Possibly not so much with regard to the machor shel achshav, the planning of the immediate future and acting towards its implementation. Very definitely, however, with regard to the machor shel achazman, if we take that term to refer to the eschatological and meta-historical tomorrow of ultimate Jewish, human, and cosmic redemption. Anxious anticipation of Yemei Samashiach, Tzipiso Yeshua, in accordance with the question formulated in the Gemara in Shabbos, that certainly exists. Concentration among the Pantero Mitzvahs as capable, among other things, of hastening the Geula, that surely obtains. But at the operational level, the sense that anything is being done, practically and rationally speaking, to advance that Geula, that sense is almost wholly absent. In part, because some of the relatively material components which comprise aspects of the messianic reality, and those aspects to which we can presumably begin to address ourselves, for instance, the reunification of Knesset Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael, the restoration of Jewish sovereignty, the enhancement of nature, the stimulation of social equality, these are not amongst the top priorities within this community. Not all that highly esteemed. The Gemara's comment in Sanhedrin, V'amar Rabbi Abbe, Ein lecho keitz megula mizeh, Shenema v'atem hora Yisrael anfechem tisou firichem titnu titenu l'ami Yisrael. Don't have a clearer sign of Yemei Samashiach, that which is stated in the pasuk in Yecheskel, we're addressing imaginatively the mountains of Israel. The Novi says, you, the mountains of Israel, you shall lift up your branch and give your fruit to my people Israel. That comment lies largely beyond the pale, beyond the ken of Haredi mentality. In part, this dimension is ignored for another reason. It is dismissed because, by and large, the conception of the division of labor between man and the Ribbono Shel Olam history is such that it is assumed in defiance of the Rambam, but perhaps in consonance with popular thought, surely, and of a number of Rishonim. It is assumed that Bias HaMashiach, or from this point of view, perhaps one should rather say Havas HaMashiach, is wholly within the purview of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And thirdly, in large measure, although here cause and effect intermesh, there is the additional factor of the divorce from Tanakh and the world of Nevuah, which is unfortunately so characteristic of the Haredi Torah world. There is little in the way of imaginative vision of limiting the contours of an ideal world, much less of acting on its behalf. sensuous world, by contrast, is generally in the reverse position. In consonance with its link to modernity, it is deeply animated by a sense of historical fulfillment. And, particularly Nazi Israel, strives, often shallowly, but nevertheless genuinely, to advance, to enhance its realization. Its contribution to Kibbutz Goliath and the resettlement of Eretz Yisrael, to the incipient rejuvenation of Mamlachas Yisrael, to unprecedented Kibbutz Goliath, all this is a matter of impressive record. That record has been achieved, moreover, not merely out of a desire, laudable in its own right, to help fellow Jews in distress, but out of commitment to tikkun olam, to changing, transforming, transmuting the world, out of a sense that all of these activities, this is of course central to the perception of religious Zionism, broadly speaking, all this is done out of a sense that these are somehow steps in a redemptive process on the way to the realization of national and universal destiny. Out of longing for a day, the Melech HaMashiach, as the Rambam describes, Yisakein, Sa'olam Kulo, Lavud Es Hashem Beyachad, Shenemar, Ki oz efoch el amim sofo v'ruha likro kulam b'shem Hashem ulavdo shchem echot. Melech HaMashiach shall transform, prove, fix if you the entire world to serve the Rebbeinu Shlom together as it is written, then I shall turn to the nations in a clear voice to call all of them in the name of God and to serve Him in unison. This commitment and the resolve and sacrifice that have manifested it is admirable and surely speaks to the credit of the sensuous world and is a testament to its aspirations. However, that world is often palpably deficient, and this again, perhaps in consonance with its links to modernity, with respect to two other elements. Hayom la'asosam, and secondly, the sense of umacho l'kabel schorom. At one pole, there was insufficient appreciation of the inherent significance of teiru mitzvahs lishma, per se, quite independent of their ramifications. There was excessive inclination to ascribe significance to today only in the light of its contribution to tomorrow. Some years back, I delivered and subsequently published a lecture which dwelt upon this last point. And inasmuch as the intervening decade has only sharpened my sense of its import, permit me briefly to quote an essay of Talich V'Siyum Historia, Process and Culmination in History. בשורות האחרונות של ספרו על הרנסנס כתב וולטר פיירו, הסופר האנגלי שדגל בתורת האמנות לשם אמנות. Concluding lines of his book of the Renaissance, Walter Pater, English author, championed art for art's sake writes, well, we are all condamned, as Victor Hugo says. We are all on the sentence of death, but with a sort of indefinite reprieve. We have an interval, and then our place knows us no more. Some spend this interval in listlessness, some in high passion. The wisest, at least among the children of this world, in art and song. Of this wisdom, the poetic passion, the desire of beauty, the love of art for art's sake, has most. For art comes to you, proposing frankly to give nothing but the highest quality to your moments as they pass, and simply for those moments' sake. I commented, "Ein Yehudi yechol hashlim kemuvan im ha'amadat ha'she'ifa la'yofi v'avat ha'amanut l'shem amanut v'piskat ha'arachim o im hagdaratan kimkoch chochmat ha'chayim." החשור לגישת פיידר לזמן ולחוויה לא כגישה בלעדית אך כגישה אחת הכרחית אני סומך שתי ידי עליה בדיוק תן האיכות הגבוהה ביותר לרגעיך כשהם חולפים ופשוט לשם אותם רגעים אלא כמובן לא למען התוכן הנעתי או המנות שבהם אלא לשם עבודת הבורא שבהם. תפיסה זו מושתתת על זיקה עמוקה למצוות אהבת השם. מצווה זו תובעת בין היתר את מסכות קדוש ברוך הוא ועבודתו ללא כל קשר עם תוצאותיה במישור שכר ועונש עובד. שם תאמר, אומרת הברייתא בספרי, הרי נלמד תורה בשביל שיהיה עשיר, בשביל שיקרא רבי, בשביל שיקבל שכר לעולם הבא. תלמוד לומר לאהבה את השם. כל מה שאתם עושים, לא תעשו למאהבה. ברם, יש להדגיש כי הניתוק מפעולה תוצאותיה אינו צריך להצטמצם משכר היחיד. הוא חייב להקיף לא פחות הבטחות כלל ישראליות, יהודים היסטוריים וחזון אסכתולוגי. היום לעשותם ויהי המחר מה שיהיה, אם יהיה. וזה ביחס לביאת המשיח לא פחות מאשר ביחס למנת לוויתן. A Jew cannot, of course, come to terms or accept the positioning of the aspiration for beauty and the love of art for art's sake at the apex of our values or with their definition as the source of the wisdom of life. But as far as Plato's approach to time and experience, not as the exclusive approach, but surely as a necessary approach, I fully accept that which he says. Precisely. Give the highest quality to your moments as they pass, and simply for those moments' sake. But of course, not for the element of pleasure art that is in them, but for the sake of the service of the Ben Shleilam, which is realized through them. This conception is grounded in a profound link to the mitzvah of the love of God. That mitzvah requires, among other things, total commitment to the Ben Shleilam and his service without any regard to the consequences at the plane of personal reward and punishment. Lest you say, says the Braisa in the Sifri, I shall learn Torah in order to become wealthy, in order to be called a rabbi, in order to receive rewards in the world to come. So the Pasuk enjoins you, La'avu es Hashem, in order to love the Rabbeinu Shloilam. All which you do, you shall do solely out of love. It is important, however, to emphasize that the disjunction between the act and its consequences is not to be confined to personal reward. It needs to include no less national rewards, historical destinies, eschatological vision. Hayom la'asosam, today to perform them, and may the morrow be whatever it may be, if indeed it shall be. And this, with regard to the coming of the Messiah, no less than with respect to a portion of Gefilte Livyosa. So this is one point. The excessive inclination to value today only insofar as somehow it is the building block of tomorrow. The other extreme, having failed here to appreciate sufficiently the significance of Hayom La'asosam, the centrist or modern Orthodox Jew generally fails to apprehend fully the import of Umacho L'Kabir Schor. He is not properly attuned to the echoes of eternity, is not suffused with the sense of his being called and ultimately judged, does not take sufficient note of the transiency of life, or of its being, in Keats' phrase, the veil of soul-making. Confronted by the Mishneh in Ovitz, Rabbi Yaakov Omer, Ha'olam hazeh doma lifrozdo bifnei olam haba, haski natzvecha bifrozdo kdesh tikones nitraklin. Yaakov says this world is compared, this resembles a vestibule in comparison to the world to come. Prepare yourself in the vestibule so that you should be able to enter the palace. The modern Jew is more likely to be animated by the prospect of the Mesak in the Prezdor, fixing up the vestibule, than by the exhortation to mold himself. So, I find the problem in both communities. In light of my introduction, I'm certain you intuit what is to be my conclusion. There is need, significant need, for redress in both camps. To my confrere in the Haredi world, I urge, expand your imaginative, historical, and operational horizons. Learn to think, act, and feel in broader national universal categories. Hearken back to Yishayahu and Micha, to the Yoshu Ish Tachas Gafo, Tachas Teinoso, Vein Machid, Kifi Hashem Tzvokis Diber, Micha's message, and they shall sit each under his vine, under his fig tree, without fear, for the voice of the Lord Tzvokis has spoken. O Yishayos, לא יראי ולא ישחיסו בכל הר קודשי, כי מול אורץ דרס השם כמים ליום החסים. They shall do no wrong, there shall be no destruction in all of my holy mount, for the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as a seabed with water. Realize, experience chesed as expansive socio-historical ispashtus, extension, out of which Olam Chesed Yibona, out of which the world is built, that not just as interpersonal assistance within the clubby confines of your own neighborhoods. Reduce your egocentric geographical concentration. Develop a sharper sense of collective historical responsibility. Don't just live in history. Live historically. To my friends of the centrist world, I exhort, bear in mind that the last Navi commands, Zichru Toras Moshe Avdi, Asher Tzivisi Oseh B'Chorev Al Kol Yisrael Chukim U'Mishpatim. Remember the Torah of Moshe my servant, that which I commanded unto him in Chorev for all of Israel, laws and ordinances. Greatly intensify the level of learning at your Torah institutions. The price in Torah that you are presently paying for whatever you're adding to it is far in excess of what is practically requisite or ideologically desirable. Place greater stress upon individual spiritual development. Raise standards of knowledge and observance of halacha. Sound the transcendental note loud and clear. Appreciate modernity, if you will, but only through the prism of eternity. Lest I be misunderstood, let me emphasize that I do not long for the homogeneous amalgamation of the two camps which shall somehow meet at the median should they accept my advice to move in the respective directions. I very much believe that there can be differing emphases within the world of Avodas Hashem. Beyond a certain point, be they kuna, of which we read in this week's parsha, should be in the b'china of a lava shakoyen mido vaad shiukim midosa. The kohen shall wear a garment of cloth, which, as Chazal say, should be in accordance with his size. Moreover, circumstances differ. I take the Mesilas Yesharim statement that it is incumbent upon a person to know Leida Machavasa Be'alamai, what is his duty in his world, to mean that one must not merely know in quasi-Kantian terms the import of duty in general, but that one must know the specific contours of duty Be'olamo in his world. And I presume that if Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzater, the author of Mesilas Yesharim, that included writing novels, he did not regard that as a universal obligation. I fully subscribe to F.H. Bradley's development of this theme in his essay, My Station and Its Duties. But I believe that the mutual redress I have encouraged would leave each camp with its own identity clearly preserved, but purer and stronger. And the Klal Yisrael as a whole will be significantly richer, spiritually, and even materially. Having addressed a bit of Teichoche in two directions, I may not have a friend left in the house. Yet, seeing the truth and trying to present it as I do, I conclude with Tennyson, "I sing because I must."
This is a French writer.
Yes, please.
Could you speak a little louder? The problem is, I just feel something like an intifada.
Do
you think that the intifada was a progressive state that had been in the present time, with only Arabs and all the subjugated Jews, including by Iraq? In any case, had the Mahtera been active and perhaps stopped it in its bud when it, before it was exposed, before the Mahtera was exposed? And the comment I'd like to make was made by Aaron Salfrazik last night. He was at a Hebron dinner. And I'd like to quote him. And he stated that the cave of Machpelah belonged to Abraham. Why was Abraham so eager to pay for it, even though it was legally his? And Rabbi Soloveitchik answered, because although he had the legal right, he wanted also the psychological right. For the psychological right, you really have to fight and you have to pay for it. So the cave of Machpelah, he wanted that psychological right. Similarly, the people presently living in Hebron are giving us the psychological right to our land, which belongs to us. The same with the people in various settlements. We need that psychological right. And to give it up in any way, even compromise this, would be against not only the Torah, but the will of Hashem, but would be against all of Israel. And we're living in a real world at the present time. We see almost every day Jews being castigated and
can we afford
the luxury to compromise at this time?
This is not related to my Address are brief to what you say. Do I think that the Intifada would have been stopped had the Machteret continuous activities unbridled by the government? I think that the activity of the Machteret would in no way have served to prevent the Intifada. If anything, it was in many respects provocative. I think it is preposterous to imagine that that handful of people who were there would have had any significant, any measurable effect in stopping the Intifada. I think that is simply an illusion. I understand why people entertain it, but I think that's totally unrealistic. With regard to the latter portion of your remarks, I am a very, very great admirer of Rav Soloveitchik. He was a Rebbe of mine long before he was a relative of mine. So I can admire him too. But on certain matters, I don't agree with him. And this is one of them. Not chas v'sholem with regard to our moral right and our psychological right. All of that, I fully agree. But that is not the issue. The issue that Israel today, to the extent that the question of territorial compromise will come up, is not whether we have a moral right, or a psychological right, or a legal right, or a historical right to Maaseh Machpelah. I subscribe to that as Reb Aaron does, as every Jew is open to Pasuk Chumash does. The question is similar to that which confronted Avraham Avinu. After all of us Israel had been given to Avraham Avinu. And nevertheless, he did not feel that he needed immediately to exercise that right. And he recognized that there were certain circumstances which perhaps made it advisable to proceed in other means and to confine himself to taking just a little part of his soil and letting the rest return to his descendants at some later phase. I don't think it's a question of whether we have the right, without a doubt. But the question is it wise, is it prudent to press for that right, and to press for it at what cost? The people are living in Hevron are making a certain contribution. I don't question that. But you know that they're able to live in Hevron at other people's expense. Other people have to do miluim in Hevron. Other people have gotten killed in Hevron. In order that those people should be able to sit there. Do I think that the presence of, within the heart of Hevron, of the community which is there, is a substantive contribution to our security? The answer is categorically no. It is preposterous to imagine that the future of Hevron, or of any other part of Eretz Yisrael, is going to be determined by whether there's a square mile, and it's less than that, whether it's a square mile in the middle of Hevron, which is inhabited by Jews, and which other Jews have to spend many months in the course of a year in order to protect the people who are there. I'm extremely happy if Hevron should remain in our hands. But I don't delude myself for a moment. Whether it will or won't will depend on whether a few dozen Jews, even 100 Jews, sitting in the middle of it. If we should be able to retain all of Eretz Yisrael without having to give anything back, we will be able to retain Ramallah as well without Jews sitting in the middle of Ramallah. And if we'll have to return Ramallah, we may have to return Hevron. What is going on there at present has symbolic significance, it has emotional significance, and I admire the people who are there under very difficult conditions, and who are themselves in some measure of danger. But I think it is totally unrealistic to assume that in terms of diplomacy, from a military standpoint, in terms of what lies down the pike, that particular Yitzhashvut is going to contribute anything. It is a source of constant tension and friction. It is not a source of genuine, healthy growth and development, which is possible in many other parts of Eretz Yisrael, including many other parts of Yehuda v'Shomron. So with regard to that, my heart is all with Rabbi. But
As chairman, I don't want to turn this to a political arena, so I'm going to leave that.
I understood from a political science standpoint. Okay. Left and right. I have to do with a legitimate spectrum within that has a legitimacy. For example, a terrorist is out is chutzle machana from left to right. So I was just wondering, in terms of so-called centrist Judaism, using that label, what is the legitimate left? In order to be centrist, there has to be someone to your right. You'd be sure, I know people like that. But I know nobody to the left, so therefore, where do you come up with the term centrist?
I would only say what I regard to be is the problems on the so-called left. That is, there certainly are people on the left who define themselves, who identify themselves as being orthodox. Some of whom have come to me and advised me that I should fight for their legitimization. Because then, they said today, maybe somebody perceived me as being on the left and they attack me. If I will legitimize them, so they'll be on the left, I'll be in the center, and I'll be better off. So I know there are such people. And some of them are very sincere and very committed, and I'm not questioning the sincerity. But with regard to a number of them, I think there are very, very serious problems in the area of Ashkofis, of Emunis Fideis. With regard to issues...
Sir?
I said with regard to some of the people who identified themselves as being left-wing Orthodox, there are very significant problems with regard to matters of faith, of dogma, with regard to issues which are not simply peripheral, but with regard to certain matters which Knesset Yisrael Mikatmas Dino, from time immemorial, has regarded to be very, very crucial to the definition of Torah. And with regard to some, I don't want to get involved, you know, saying that the label is there or is not there. But that some, I certainly would not regard some themselves, see, regardless of me within the spectrum, as being within the spectrum of what I would regard legitimate orthodoxy, not so much with regard to the area of practice. Area of practice, I think most of the people who are in that camp, more or less, Hashem Remitza, I would not fault them on that score. But in areas of faith, there are some very significant problems, and surely with regard to some, I would not regard them as being a legitimate left. I don't see much point getting involved in a vagabaki as to which term you employ.
I think the terminology is significant because it's used by others as legitimizing them. And there's, for example, I have non-observant brethren who look centrist position as legitimizing them, and I therefore think it's a very significant thing. I have no objection to left-wing orthodoxy if, for example, Rabbi Lamer represents the left of a legitimate spectrum, and I have no problem with Rav Shaffer if he represents the right of a legitimate spectrum. What I'm very concerned about is others. When the New York Times says Norman Lamb is the center, well, that makes the guys on 122nd Street the legitimate left. That works.
I understand your concern. I probably am not as sensitive to it as you are, simply because I'm not here. But I think it's a, it's an interesting, possibly important point.
And thank you.
Yes, sir.
While you praise them for their commitment to Judaism, at the same time, we're somewhat critical of them not aspiring to a more ideal world. Now, I have two questions there. One, who, if any, is responsible for this attitude in the Haredi world? Is it the lay leaders? Is it the yeshiva leaders? Who is responsible for the Haredi community not taking more active role in, let's say, in worldly affairs? And secondly, is what suggestions do you have for them to do at the present time to reach the, what you call, the more ideal world?
Well, I don't think that, you know, if I were looking for a particular address there, that it would be the lay leadership. The tone in that world is set and properly set by Gedolei Torah, to whom people really, by and large, defer. In some cases, they just, you know, they make a show of deferring, but on critical issues, they really defer. The question in two ways, therefore, really has to do with certain aspects of the Torah world per se. And this, I think, is in part, although I don't want to exaggerate this, but I think it's in part due to the failure on the part of much of that community to adjust in any significant way to the reality of Eretz Yisrael. I think it would be very readily understood, as long as Jews were in the diaspora, in particular the diaspora, where by and large they were really powerless to mold society around them. So number one, the empathy for the society around them was minimal, because it was a society which generally tyrannized, etc. It was a society which by and large was very low level. And beyond that, even if there had been a desire to, you know, to take the Cossack and the Polak and his world and build it as a new heaven and new earth, clearly the possibility for doing that didn't exist, and the priorities were all elsewhere. Under those circumstances, I think it's fully understandable that there was a disjuncture from the kind of things that I was talking about. I say this not critically. I think in those circumstances that really was the right thing to do at an operational level. My feeling would have been, and to some extent applies to the present as well, that perhaps more should have been done to keep the dream alive, even knowing that it's a dream and it can't be done. But clearly at a popular level, the situation of such helplessness, and in many cases seeming hopelessness, the dream can't be pushed up further and further off, and the push further off is in effect to throw the keys up to the Rebbeinu. That's what it boiled down to. And I think that much of that pertains within the Haredi world today, even though I think the circumstances have changed, and I think that it should reorient to that. Maybe some of the failure to that had to do with the response to the fact that Zionism was to such an extent the secular hands. Even the Netziv, who was so positive towards Zionism, basically cooled his ardor somewhat when, you know, he heard more and more who was carrying the ball. It's conceivable that if, you know, there had been a vacuum of religious Jews that picked up the gauntlet, maybe many more Gedolim would have championed its cause, and that would have been both cause and effect of a renewed historical consciousness. But inasmuch as that was not the case, so there was this negative response to the fact that Atisov was being rebuilt by so much Kiddush Shabbos, etc., etc. And then there was a sense that not only did you have what you had in the diaspora, namely a kind of powerlessness, but here you had Mamish and the Mikdash itself, Eretz HaKodesh, that itself was being violated. That was even worse than what happened before. And here, even more reason to back off from trying to be Misakin Olam and to leave Tikkun Olam again to the Rebbeinu Shleilam. I think that's unfortunate, but I Chas V'Sholem do not pin blame for those dealing with responders they did in that way. I think that there's tremendous godlessness on the part of Rav Kook to have been able to transcend that. To my mind, the most significant contribution. So I wish that something of that spirit could animate many others at present as well. But unfortunately, I think the situation is pretty much as I described it. With regard to your second question, in terms of specifics, what we're dealing here with